This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 22, 2002. I'm Nell Abram. President Bush plans to meet the Colombian president this weekend as Colombian farmers tell Congress about the real effects of Plan Colombia. Walmart, the nation's largest employer, succeeds in keeping union organizers away from workers. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Rob Manning with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Bush told the UN Summit on Poverty today that U.S. aid to poor nations comes with strings attached. Susan Wood has more from New York.
In outlining his new foreign aid doctrine, Bush pledged to spend an additional $10 billion over the next 3 years, but only on countries that commit to open markets and fighting corruption. The European Union pledged $7 billion, but the combined promises fall well short of the $100 billion the UN says will be needed to cut extreme poverty in half by 2015. Cuban President Fidel Castro, meanwhile, denounced the so-called Monterey Consensus adopted at the close of this week's gathering, describing the global economic system as a form of genocide. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
A plea for more money before the House Armed Services Committee. Gareth Schweitzer reports from Washington.
The United States is the only major nuclear power that is unable to manufacture the nuclear components for its nuclear warheads.
Although that sounds worrisome, Dr. John Foster of the National Nuclear Security Administration may have other motivations for issuing such a warning. President Bush has stated he wants to reduce the nuclear arsenal to between 1,700 and 2,200 warheads over the next 10 years, but those warheads will be removed from operation and stored, not destroyed. According to Tom Colina, director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, raising concern about our inability to build nuclear parts could validate storing and not destroying our nuclear arsenal, and could encourage the Russians to do the same.
The goal here is to motivate not only the production or the building of a new facility to produce plutonium parts, which is really what we're talking about, but also the maintenance of a large reserve of nuclear weapons to make up for the need for parts. But the reality is that plutonium parts last a very long time.
In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
At the North Sea Summit, Ireland and Norway's environment ministers complained that other countries' nuclear discharges are polluting their coasts. From Copenhagen, Patrick Beckett.
Ministers of nine countries bordering the North Sea announced their intention to expand the production of renewable offshore wind energy, develop protected marine areas, and decrease pollution from land-based and offshore sources. The ministers made their declaration at the Fifth North Sea Conference in Bergen, Norway, this week. While recognizing the positive aspects of the declaration, environmental groups, including Greenpeace, criticized France and Britain for their continued radioactive pollution of the North Sea. The Sellafield reprocessing plant in Britain is viewed as an ongoing source of radioactive discharge. In Copenhagen, I'm Patrick Beckett for Free Speech Radio News.
Condemned Texas inmate Rodolfo Hernandez received a stay moments before his scheduled execution last night. Mary O'Grady has more from Austin.
Texas Governor Rick Perry yesterday granted Rodolfo Hernandez a 30-day stay of execution 2 minutes before Hernandez was to be executed by lethal injection. San Antonio police reportedly asked for the stay to allow them time to question Hernandez about as many as 12 unsolved murders. They had interviewed Hernandez Wednesday night after Hernandez told his spiritual advisor details not known to the public about at least two unsolved killings. Rodolfo Hernandez was convicted of the 1985 robbery and shooting of five undocumented immigrants. One robbery victim, 20-year-old Victor Servan of San Luis Potosí in northern Mexico, died after Hernandez shot him. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mary O'Grady in Austin.
Finally, an Islamic court is set to decide the fate of a woman appealing her sentence of death by stoning for adultery. Sam Olakoya reports from Lagos, Nigeria.
5-year-old Safiya Tunga Tubu was sentenced to death by an Islamic court in Sokoto, northern Nigeria, last year for adultery. The evidence against her was that she was pregnant outside wedlock. The death sentence was suspended for 1 year to allow her give birth and take care of the baby. Her time is now up, except the appeal court overturns the death sentence. Safiya, who is a divorcee, is appealing the death sentence on grounds that her former husband was responsible for the pregnancy. When her appeal was heard early this week, the government lawyer prosecuting the case faulted her defense. Quoting from the Holy Quran, he told the appeal court that stoning to death is the penalty for anybody who commits adultery, whether once married or not. Critics say it is shameful in the 21st century for a court to order somebody's death by stoning, but Islamic hardliners say the law under which she was sentenced to death is a law from God which has to be obeyed, no matter what anybody thinks. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rob Manning.
In Lima, Peru this weekend, President Bush will meet with South American leaders, including Colombian President Andre Pastrana. The White House is asking Congress for more money to expand the anti-narcotics program known as Plan Colombia. Among other components, President Bush wants to expand aerial fumigation of illegal drug crops. A group of Colombian farmers told Congress this week the fumigation is a failure and it's poisoning their families and their lands. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington, Congress may be listening more closely to big campaign donors than South American peasants.
Under Plan Colombia, the United States is sending over $1 billion in military aid for the stated reason of getting farmers out of the business of growing coca and opium poppies. In this week's talks, many called the aerial fumigation component of Plan Colombia a failure. But the Bush administration is asking Congress to double the scope of the fumigations. While on a trip to Colombia, Minnesota Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone was accidentally sprayed with herbicides.
I'm the only, I think, member of the Congress with that distinction. We have to be concerned about the environmental effects, the public health effects, and there has to be alternative social development monies available for people, for some alternatives to growing the coca crop. The reports that I have received as a senator is that social on the ground, that's just not happening. I do not view this fumigation and the spraying as having been very successful, since it just looks like campesinos are just moving from one place to another, and we continue to have the drugs coming into the United States, not really to any lesser extent.
Colombian farmers say they're coming down with a variety of illnesses as a result of the spraying. Diva Calderon is a government epidemiologist in Colombia. She briefed U.S. congressional staff this week.
Estos problemas, ¿cuáles fueron? Fueron problemas de piel.
In the places they've been fumigating, we have people coming in with problems of the skin, problems of the gastrointestinal system, dizziness, fever, and general bad health.
With U.S. funding, the Colombian government is paying U.S. contractors to spray a highly concentrated version of the herbicide Roundup, a product of the Monsanto company. Monsanto also made Agent Orange, the toxic defoliant used in the Vietnam War. Like Agent Orange, Roundup is a non-selective herbicide, meaning that any plant exposed to it will die. Colombian farmers brought pictures to Capitol Hill showing their legal food crops dying in the fields, collateral damage of the war on drugs. Thousands of rural Colombians have been displaced by the fumigation, which they say is also killing fish and livestock. All the while, says Eder Sanchez, the coca continues to be planted. Sanchez is a leader of the National Association of Small Farmers in Nariño province of Colombia and a local legislator.
The people who are spraying, the people who say they are anti-drugs, they don't know the areas where we live. There's no coca or poppies in some of these areas they spray. They're even spraying crops like palm hearts and pimentos that the Colombian government subsidizes.
Sanchez says the Congress people who voted for Plan Colombia did not intend for Colombian farmers to suffer as a side effect of the drug war, but so far, only a handful of lawmakers have expressed concern about the fumigations. Samho Tree traces political money for the Institute for Policy Studies in D.C. He says the reason some Congress people may be mum is that the manufacturer of the Black Hawk helicopter makes a lot of money supplying the Colombians with crop-dusting aircraft. Tree points to the Connecticut delegation in Congress, which was instrumental in passing Plan Colombia.
This delegation has traditionally been one of the best delegations in terms of human rights in Latin America. Christopher Dodd, Senator Dodd, Congressman Rosa DeLauro, and Sam Gagenson, these people have been champions of human rights. And yet they all voted lockstep in favor of approving this aid to Colombia. And if you look at Sikorsky Helicopters and their parent company, United Technologies, that makes the Black Hawk helicopters, they spent a great deal of money funding the campaigns of these members of Congress from Connecticut, about $10,000 apiece. Senators Dodd and Lieberman took between $30,000 to $35,000 apiece, according to the Center for Responsive Politics.
Not all the lawmakers Sam Hotree names could be reached for comment, but a spokesman for Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro says if there's any connection between the campaign contributions from the helicopter company and Plan Colombia, it's because the Black Hawk is the best equipped to fight the drug war. A spokesman for Senator Dodd says Dodd will take an active role in a Foreign Relations Committee meeting next month to look into the human rights and fumigation issues in Colombia. Dodd's spokesman says there's absolutely no connection between Black Hawk helicopters and the senator's position on human rights. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
An election at the Texas energy company, Reliant, ended with workers choosing against union representation yesterday. Field technicians chose to remain unaffiliated with the Electrical Workers Union. But union organizers say Reliant called in a union-busting firm to scare workers away from voting pro-union. With more on energy and employment, here's Joe Gardner-Wesley in Houston.
Union supporters rallied all day outside Reliant Service Center, where voting took place. 113 field service representatives passed by to vote on whether to get representation from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, or IBEW. The field service reps, who turn power on and off when customers move or don't pay their bills, chose 42-71 against IBEW representation. IBEW organizer Mike Mostit says Reliant supervisors were having captive audience meetings daily for the past month with employees.
The company has hired a consulting, so-called union-busting company that has come in and educated the workers on why they don't need a union. And we feel like they've been telling a lot of half-truths.
Mostit claims that Reliant threatened workers by saying their starting negotiated pay would be minimum wage if they joined. Most other public utility electrical workers and contractors in the area are unionized. Frederick, a Reliant electrician, says since Texas is a right-to-work state, Reliant can determine wages and benefits of unaffiliated workers at will.
So they can come and change their wages whenever they want. They can come and take their vacation when they want. They can come and raise their health insurance premiums whenever they want. And as far as I know right now, on the energy production side, which will be all the power plant salary people, they've already had their retirement taken from them, and they've already had their retiree medical taken from them. So they paid them off. They gave them a lump sum to put in their 401k.
Frederick thinks there's a danger that the salaried service representatives who voted against union representation yesterday will get no defined benefits and will end up like Enron employees with only a 401k plan for their retirement. Andrew Wheat, research director at the not-for-profit watchdog group Texans for Public Justice, says Reliant has been aggressively pursuing power generation assets in Latin America and the rest of the world. But Wheat adds that Reliant's massive size is no assurance for workers.
The Enron example is one that would suggest that, even highly paid mid-management level workers in the company that sort of put blind faith in the company taking care of them and their interests was a mistake, and that when push came to shove, the company was quick to sell its middle management and lower level workers downriver.
Yet the majority of field service representatives who voted at Reliant yesterday didn't see it that way and voted not to have the IBEW represent them. Reliant spokesperson Alicia Dixon says the company is pleased with the result of the vote and thinks the employees felt it was more beneficial not to have third-party representation.
We gave our employees the facts, and employees were able to take the information and do what they wanted with it. Our employees are free to choose whatever they wish. And they voted after the education process to not organize and felt it was more beneficial for them to deal with us directly.
Union organizers say they will continue to reach out to workers who they feel have been intimidated. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley in Houston.
Last Friday, Walmart won a major victory in its fight to remain union-free when an Arkansas judge issued a court injunction barring union organizers from its stores. The company successfully argued that organizers with the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union who approach Walmart employees in the workplace can be arrested for trespassing. But as John Hamilton reports, the injunction will not deter the union's efforts to organize Walmart's 1 million workers.
A generation ago, General Motors was the nation's largest employer, providing hundreds of thousands of workers with the equivalent of more than $17 an hour and benefits. Today, Walmart is the nation's top employer, and the average wage for the company's retail workers stands at only about $7.50 an hour. The company remains 100% union-free.
While unions may be right for other companies, they don't have a place here. And the reason we our associates continue to send that message very strongly to union organizers is because they can speak for themselves.
According to Jessica Mosier of Walmart Public Relations, the company received a rash of complaints after the United Food and Commercial Workers Union began organizing efforts at Walmart stores in 1999. Mosier says her company welcomed Friday's court ruling by Arkansas Chancery Judge Jim Spears, which she says will end union harassment of Walmart associates.
We were happy that the judge ruled that unions can no longer come into our stores and solicit our associates inside of our facilities throughout the United States.
That interpretation of the injunction is decidedly different from the UFCW's. Union organizer Mike Leonard says the court's decision will only prohibit members of the international union from entering stores in the state of Arkansas.
The bottom line on the injunction is that, you know, Walmart doesn't have a problem with the UFCW. Walmart has a problem with their own people. It's their own people who are asking us to come.
Despite Walmart's insistence that its employees are content to work without collective bargaining rights, workers have made strides towards organizing Walmart stores throughout the country. In 2000, meat cutters at a Walmart supercenter in Jacksonville, Texas, voted to join the United Food and Commercial Workers. The company immediately closed meat departments at Walmart supermarkets across the country. The UFCW has filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board, and the case is still under litigation.
Walmart's answer to everything is to go to court. That's where they seek refuge from the reality that their workers aren't satisfied or treated very well.
And while the United Food and Commercial Workers have yet to successfully organize even one bargaining unit at a Walmart store, they have succeeded in attracting a great deal of interest in the union. Bill Meyer of the UFCW's Strategic Programs Department says that Walmart's low-wage jobs have angered many store employees in Las Vegas, the most heavily unionized city in America.
Naturally, when the culture of Bentonville, Arkansas, infiltrated the metropolitan area of Las Vegas, a lot of workers were dissatisfied with the wages, hours, and working conditions, and some chose that a union was the best way to try to improve their situation rather than leave the company and try to find something else.
Meyer says that the company has pulled out all the stops in its effort against unions in Las Vegas. He says UFCW organizers who enter Walmart stores to pass out leaflets are routinely ejected.
The company holds captive audience meetings. The employees there are very difficult to reach after the working hours because most have to work two jobs. And like the rest of us, have very active lives outside of work.
With on-the-job organizing efforts rendered all but impossible by the company, the UFCW has turned to alternative methods of communication.
Hello and welcome to Worker Voice Radio. This informational and call-in talk show is a production of Walmart and Sam's Club workers from Las Vegas and across the country.
On the AM radio station KLAV in Las Vegas, UFCW organizers have created Worker Voice Radio, a one-hour-a-week program devoted entirely to issues facing Walmart and Sam's Club employees. Every Tuesday, the program is simulcast over the Internet and has attracted the interest of Walmart workers from across the U.S. and Canada. Las Vegas Walmart employees can even log on to a UFCW website and sign an online authorization card. Mike Leonard says his union has had to rely on creative campaigns in order to bypass Walmart's union-busting efforts.
This is the richest company in America. I think the last Fortune 500 richest people, they were number 6 through 10 as a family. Tell these people that they can stand up and get some paid-for health care and some better wages and a better life, and they can do it with a union. And UFCW is going to be there to fight for them for as long as it takes.
While members of the UFCW's international union may be barred from entering Walmart supercenters, organizers with UFCW local unions say they plan to continue their efforts inside stores. Walmart has vowed to take them to court wherever they do. With the Workers' Independent News Service for Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton.
The Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. today released an explosive new report saying that Enron Corporation was able to become a global giant only because government agencies, both American and foreign, gave it more than $7 billion in publicly funded financing over the past decade. Since 1992, at least 21 agencies representing the United States government, multilateral development banks, and other national governments helped leverage Enron's global reach by approving $7.2 billion in public financing toward 38 projects in 29 countries. For example, in India, police hired by the Power Consortium, of which Enron was a part, beat nonviolent protesters who challenged the $30 billion agreement, the largest deal in Indian history, struck between local politicians and Enron. The president of Guatemala tried to dissolve the Congress and declare martial law after rioting ensued, following a price hike that the government deemed necessary after selling the power sector to Enron. Enron is also involved in a controversial gas pipeline project in Bolivia. Tim Russo reports from Cochabamba.
In the wake of incessant trials and scandals in the United States, Enron is becoming exposed for its corruption and deep-rooted involvement in the international setting. Enron and its subsidiaries have been involved in shady deals with South American governments while in collusion with U.S. embassies that have applied diplomatic measures on behalf of the company, permitting it to disregard environmental standards, belittle local authorities, and cause severe impact on communities in return for unprecedented profits, such is the case in Enron's little-known, marred, and controversial history in Bolivia, nothing less than illustrative of its behavior in Latin America on the whole. Tom Cruz from the Center for Studies in Labor and Agricultural Development in Bolivia commented on Enron's presence in Bolivia.
Enron is responsible for the largest on-land oil spill in South American history.
Marco Gandarias, the lead investigator for petroleum affairs at the Center for Documentation and Investigation of Bolivia, CEDIP, described the latent controversy surrounding Enron's inception in Bolivia when they moved to expedite the privatization and subsequently monopolize this country's national oil company, YPFB.
Obviously, the contract that was signed between Enron and YPFB has been considered illegal because the contract was first signed in the United States and under their courts and laws. Afterwards, much later, a year afterwards in 1997, the contract was made adequate for Bolivian norms. It was transcribed from English to Spanish, and a series of decrees were made to create validity for the previously signed contract. Enron, when it signed the contract with YPFB, according to our courts, was a company that did not exist in Bolivia. It was a company that only 2 months after signing the contract obtained legal status and legal existence in Bolivia. Today, at present, Enron is a company that controls, along with Shell, the principal oil line in Bolivia, the pipeline Bolivia-Brasil. Enron and Shell are co-proprietors of the entire national system for oil transportation and pipelines in Bolivia. In the pipeline to Brazil, they have 59% as Enron Shell, as Transredes, as they're called here, because under that name they privatized YPFB and gained control of the national pipelines and have total control of the entire national system that was handed over without concessions.
Tom Cruz described the nature of the oil spill caused by Enron's Bolivian subsidiary, Transredes, that contaminated Lake Popo and the principal high-altitude aquifer in Bolivia. According to CEDIP, this is just one of more than an estimated 5 environmental disasters annually directly involving Transredes and Enron.
A number of the communities got a number of things, tractors, a school repainted, a plaza paved, symbolic little bits of money flowed, but nothing even remotely close to the real cost of those communities, the oil spill. It is the largest on-land oil spill in South American history. What that means is, you know, millions and millions of barrels of oil just spilled all over the land, killing everything. The companies claimed to have, you know, taken care of it, but I don't buy it. They don't buy it. A couple of communities don't buy it either.
Emilio Gonzalez, previously a Transredes pipeline inspector, shared his views on the principal factors that could have caused or potentially prevented these disasters from occurring.
In reality,
What happened in Oscone was an administrative problem, because it turns out that there were only two people at the plant in charge of controlling the entire plant. One person worked during the day and one worked during the night. Previously, there had been many people working at each plant, but at the time that it was privatized, when the gringos came to administer everything, they tried to be more efficient, so they reduced the workforce. But I don't know to what point one person can manage various functions.
Mr. Gandarias deconstructed the reasons as to why the more than 220 communities that were directly affected by this oil spill never received compensation. The interests described here were subject to scrutiny last week in La Paz when the House of Deputies moved to establish a special commission to investigate and report on the legality of Enron's political ties in Bolivia.
During the time that Enron has been in Bolivia, it is the oil company that has most contaminated the country. In all of the conflicts that Enron has been involved in Bolivia, and there have been various, above all of an environmental character, Enron has always been very favored by the United States government. Donna Renac, who was the American ambassador a few years ago in Bolivia, pressured very hard so that this company wouldn't be sanctioned. For example, in the oil spill in the Desaguadero caused very severe environmental contamination that Transredes generated in the western part of Bolivia and Lake Popo. She personally pressured and warned the Bolivian government that she would not permit them to sanction Enron for the environmental damages caused in Bolivia.
Yet for Ronaldo Gutierrez, a Coquelero leader from the coca-growing zone in the Chapucuchapare region, there can be no pardon for the oil spills or Enron's involvement in the destruction of the world's last remaining dry wetlands area, the Chiquitano Forest. According to local sources, the Chiquitano was destroyed in order to build Transredes' direct pipeline to Brazil, while simultaneously selling illegal rights to pharmaceutical companies to pirate and patent the forest's vast wealth and biological diversity, all with the blessing of the World Wildlife Federation as an ecologically sound project.
In particular, in the tropics, is the Bulwark case. For example, the company Transredes has occupied, totally capitalized, and privatized this area. We think that it's time to recuperate the transnationals that are here in our country. For more than 500 years, we have been humiliated, exploited, and hated. Now it's time to react and rise up. If it's not in good hands, if we haven't been able to make the changes, organically and politically, we have to say that there will be a rebellion, a revolution in order to rescue all of the land and the state networks in our country, in order to erase this corruption. How can we believe that Bolivia is the champion of corruption? But it's true. Nepotism and corruption are totally present in our Bolivia.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo in Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Free Speech Radio News was produced at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California, and Community Radio WMNF in Tampa, Florida. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jade Paget-Seekins. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Joshua Chaffin in Washington, D.C. I've reported for Free Speech Radio News from California and Brazil. Now I'm on Capitol Hill. I work for Free Speech Radio News because it's the only place that lets me give an honest account of what's happening in the news. But Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a donation online at fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thank you for your support.